Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show. I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Once again, this is Carson's Corner, and my name is Bob Carson, and I am pleased to be with you. It is September 20th, 2019, just after 10:30 p.m. here, Eastern Standard Time. We have a great show for you, as always. Before we get to our guests, let me just tell you what we got going on here tonight. We're going to talk, of course, about the Valor Bare Knuckle event, Ken Shamrock's first event. He's the main head honcho behind this event, but there's other investors and other people that's bringing you this historic event that's taking place tomorrow at the Four Bears Casino Lodge in North Dakota. And we're going to be talking to Bobby Wambacher. He's on the line right now. He's going to be the main man there refereeing the event. We want to talk to Bobby. We're going to talk to him about what's going on there and some other issues. And if you want to give us a call, you can at 347-326-9749. That's 347-326-9749. We always have the phones open for you, and we'll have the chat room open for you as well if you want to chime in there with a question, comment, or concern. It is Friday. I'm off. I have vacation. I'm so happy. I'm so proud, ladies and gentlemen. I'm off the next, 12 days or so. So I'm really, really happy about that. But enough of that. Let's go to Bobby, who's over there now in North Dakota there. Bobby, welcome to Carson's Corner, man. How are you? Bobby, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
How are you? Yes, sir.
Fantastic.
Thank you for calling in, man. Yeah, good to hear from you. Thank you for calling. I really appreciate it. How are things there? You just had the rules meeting a couple hours ago. I'm assuming. How did everything go?
Everything is great. We had the weigh-in this morning, and then did the face-off tonight. And it's going to be an explosive card. Don't blink.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. A lot of people are looking forward to it, and this is really, really something special. It really is. Anything that you could tell us, this is Ken's first and promotional event. Anything that kind of feels different about this event, maybe than you know you've reffed in the past.
I guess the biggest thing is when we walk into the event center and there's no cage and there's no ring. It is a completely different format. The fighting surface is different than we've seen. It's going to be great, and I look forward to being in there tomorrow in the pit.
Yeah, absolutely. But
have
in
you
any event,
pictures of it?
Not really. I interviewed Ken about a couple months ago, but actually last month or so, and I just been really really kind of tied up and whatnot. But it almost I've heard it almost sort of looks reminiscent. I don't know if it's of the Yama pit that they introduced years ago in 2008. I don't know if it's similar to that. If you remember what Bob Meyerowitz did, is it at all similar to that?
It is. It's
okay.
I think it's the inner circle is 20 feet, and then they've got a red zone around that where the fighters, once they get to that, they got to get out of there and get more centered. And it's going to be like nothing I've ever been involved with. And so personally, I'm super excited about it. And you know, I've done bare knuckle before, and one of the big differences is, for me anyway, is most of those fights do not go to cards. Like they are out there, and they're going to finish. And you know, on this card alone, it's mainly heavyweights from top to bottom, and you know, just like in MMA or boxing, when you get the heavyweights in there, you know, and they connect, it's over. It's good night.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And even with the Yama, when I covered that, there was a cage, but there was a little bit like of an incline. Like when you know you went like towards the end of the surface, there was like sort of like that incline, but there was still a cage. But this is absolutely no cage whatsoever from what I understand. So it's like it's as a referee, is that gonna present a little bit more challenge on your part? Like, I mean, or how is it sort of designed? Is it there any type of enclosure, or is it just sort of this open surface there?
It's open surface. It has an incline after the red line that goes up, I want to say 4 feet or so at a slight incline. However, the views for the fans, they're going to be, it's going to be a very intimate setting, whereas it's going to be like they're in it. There's no real barrier. It's you know,
okay.
The fighters are up there, and there's no cage, there's no ropes. It is.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so then it's almost exactly like the Yama setup without the cage. That's awesome. And then it wouldn't be. So they wouldn't go past that barrier since there is the incline, and that's pretty much the barrier. Then. You know, and you know, pretty much if you watch, you know, David Feldman's events, you know, the way that they start the fighters, and you don't have a lot of guys just kind of moving that far apart. So I think that it's going to bring a lot of action, you know, to the fans out there. So that should be really really exciting. That's very very unique setup there. So it's good that they designed it like that, and it should be really really fun.
Yeah, I think
now, many,
whoever tunes in is not going to be disappointed. That's for certain.
Absolutely. Many fans know you as a referee for many promotions, including but not limited to the UFC. And over the past years, we here on the show have loved to talk to referees and judges and commission members and other officials from combat sports. But you know, and we've always appreciated the contributions of people fighting, and people that are not fighting in the cage and whatnot, and Yama Pit, as I mentioned. But referees in particular have a real unique perspective, and I think a difficult job, oftentimes a thankless job. You know, and I've been very critical of some referees, including like Herb Dean and whatnot. But I want to talk a little bit about how you got involved in this wacky sport. Because a lot of referees that I've known, they've trained in martial arts prior to getting involved. Were you originally training to be a fighter? Did you have some sort of involvement in martial arts before you got involved as a referee?
Yes, I was training to fight, and then I had a injury on my shoulder blade that was going to keep me out for 6 months, and I had thought I can't be out of the sport for 6 months, and I had lived in Hollywood for a little while, and I remember getting a flyer on my car for Herb Dean's course, and so when this happened, I had that flyer still, so I pulled it out, and I thought, well, shoot, I'll just go rep. And that'll be easy. I mean, shoot, I know all the rules, just like everybody else. Yeah, I spent a lot of money, went to that class, and failed miserably. There was a lot more to reffing than just knowing the rules. So I was like, okay. And I went back, and I studied, and I practiced, and everything that I needed to. And since then, I've passed 8 ABC courses, including Herb's. But it's very challenging, and... just because you see it on TV and you know some of the rules, or you think you know what's going on, I mean, there's so many little intricate pieces to what is actually happening in there and what a referee's role is. And, it's very, very challenging and very difficult, and I absolutely love it.
How long was the course, was Herb's course?
It was a Friday and Saturday, and you go in and you watch fights, you discuss them, you discuss the rules. But the part I wasn't totally prepared for is you got to be able to apply the holds. Any hold that they mention, you got to be able to apply it. And then most importantly, as a referee, you've got to be able to disassemble it without injuring the fighter. So if they're in an arm bar, you got to know where to push, when to push, where to pull, and all of that stuff, so that you don't damage the fighter's arm and you actually save it. Because if you push the wrong way, you're gonna do more damage. And if you don't do it at the right time, his or her arm could break before it gets released. So I mean, there's a lot of little pieces that as a referee you got to know where to be and what you're doing at all times.
Now you mentioned you failed. The first time, would you say that there was a high failure rate amongst people that took the course the first time?
Yeah,
at least?
I think the pass rate's like 34 or 38%. It's very low.
Yeah.
And for a reason. I mean, it's very difficult. When you get in the cage or in the ring with two competitors that, especially if they're professionals, where their livelihood's at stake, You can't have an off night. In basketball or football or baseball,
right.
You can have an off night. You've got 160 other games. Those two competitors can't have an off night for them because there's a lot riding on it for them. So, it's very difficult, and a lot of people, go out and try it and fail and quit and don't stick with it. And then there's some that just are like me or stubborn and say, okay, I failed. I'm going to figure out how to get better at this, and I'm going to go back and do it again and again and again and again until I master it, and then I get in the cage.
Now, I thought I read that you had at least some of your training under one of the most underrated minds and coaches in MMA history and a pioneer of the sport, Jeremy Horn. Can you talk a little about how you got hooked up with Horn for training in the first place?
Absolutely. I had moved around for my company that I was working for at the time, and that's what had me in LA, and then they moved me to Salt Lake. And I was born and raised in Central Illinois, which is about where I grew up, is Taylorville, Illinois. And Matt Hughes grew up about 20-25 minutes from there in Hillsboro, and he's a couple years older than me. So through high school, we just heard about this tremendous wrestler and all this other stuff. And then, when he got involved, I started following it and, followed the sport more. Well, obviously, as you know the story, Matt trained with Jeremy and Pat and all those guys. And so when I went to Salt Lake, I was like, all right, I'm going to go check out Jeremy Horn's gym as a fan type of thing. And I got in there, and you know, it was awesome. And I decided that's where I was going to start training and start that journey, and I don't regret it.
Now, in terms of modern MMA technique that combines both grappling and striking, I think Horn may have contributed more to the knowledge than just about anyone else during his era. I mean, you know, back you know, years ago. I mean, him and Mario Sperry, I think in some ways probably are the fathers of the current era of MMA in that respect. And I remember listening to an interview with Jens Pulver, where he actually said that Horn deserved a lot of the credit that Pat Miletich received at the time in terms of the Miletich fighting team and their success. You know, it was just amazing his contributions to the sport and whatnot. I don't think it can be understated what he did in terms of his contributions. How would you describe the importance of Jeremy Horn, you know, to the sport as it stands today, in terms of the newer fans? How would they appreciate him? Do you think he's kind of underrated in terms of contributors to the sport?
I do. I think that he doesn't get the credit he deserves, and maybe because he didn't, win the UFC title or something. But when you sit down and talk to him, and you know, I enjoy every opportunity I get to sit down and talk MMA with him. He's got so much knowledge and just his experience. I mean, he's got, I don't know the number of fights he has anymore. It's over 100. And just listening to the stories from the old days and just, you know, going from one fight event to the next night doing another one somewhere else and, you know, not getting paid. And I mean, it's crazy. And I do think that he played a huge role in that Miletich's camp success when they were dominating. I have the utmost respect for Jeremy.
You mentioned Matt Hughes. What was it about Matt Hughes that you looked up to, both in terms of fighting and character?
Well, I mean, the first thing is he was kind of like the local guy. He was close to where I was from. He was a country boy, all those things that I could relate to. And he was going in and winning these fights. And at that time, you know, it wasn't as mainstream as it is now. You know, I was telling I was having this conversation the other day, but I remember back in that time, there was a UFC maybe every 3 months, maybe. And I mean, you really look forward to it, and you got everybody together, and I mean, it was a big thing because it was only every 3 months, and now it's, you know, every weekend essentially. So people nowadays that are getting into it are kind of spoiled. You know, back then it was like a big thing to have an event. So I looked at that and the fact that he was winning and he was a local guy, and and then obviously he was with Miletich and that group, which was, again, not too far from where I was at in Bettendorf, Iowa. So, I thought that, he was my guy. And I can say that now,
you know,
because he doesn't fight any longer.
Yeah, and at one point, you know, Hughes was one of the most respected champions in the sport, and I think, you know, as a champion, he certainly his fighting career certainly shines on. Although, you know, in recent years, he's become a very controversial and even tragic figure, enduring some hardships. And there's been some real behind the scene rumors that Hughes could be a bully towards people. Then there was that. His book that came out recently, and there was stories came out about him, being abusive towards training partners and relatives, to the point of violence. Was that something that you ever heard of firsthand or secondhand, Bobby, when you were in that area?
Nope, that's nothing that ever surfaced or you know, anything like that.
Yeah. Do you think that Matt Hughes gets a bad rap at all?
I don't know if he gets a bad rap, but I do think that maybe, you know, I think it, being that I'm from the Midwest and I'm used to that, you know, the way people talk and the way people act and things like that, I think a lot of people mischaracterize some of the things he has said and some of the things maybe that he represents. But I don't know that either. That's just my assumption because, you know, when I hear people speaking poorly of him, I go back and I try to figure out why. And some of the things, you know, that people say and, you know, it just doesn't add up. So, you know, it is what it is. My personal opinion is I think he was a hell of a fighter. I think that, you know, I think highly of him, and I don't think that everything that's in the press and the internet and things like that are accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I felt empathy for him when he had his accident. I think most people felt sympathy for him, even if they you know, disliked him as a person or if they read things about him that maybe they didn't like. You know, I also felt some empathy for you reading about the insane schedule you put in to establish yourself as an MMA referee when you know, we were prepping for this interview. I read in a previous interview of yours that you actually attribute the failure of a previous marriage to all the refereeing commitments you had to keep up with when you were trying to establish yourself as a referee in the United States. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. In the beginning, a lot of people don't realize this. Obviously, as a referee, we don't get paid a fortune. But to get involved,
sure.
Typically, someone, you know, California is kind of a unique situation. Nevada is a unique situation because they have a lot of fights. But when I started in Utah, you know, there may be one fight a month. And there were two or three other referees. So it may be every 3 or 4 months before you would get an opportunity. And when I passed Herb's class and the other ABC classes, it took me 6 months from the time I passed the test before I got my first opportunity. Because everybody wants you to be experienced. Everybody wants you to, you know, have cage time. But nobody wants to give you the cage time because you don't have the cage time. And so it's just it's a vicious circle. And so for me, I just traveled. I went to Wyoming. I went to New Mexico. I went to Nebraska. I went to Kansas. I went to Arizona. I went to Texas. You know, and I would go and I would show up and I would try to get on one. Just give me one fight. That's all I want. And I forget now the mileage I put on, but it was close to 80,000 miles, 70 or 80,000 miles in 1 year.
Wow.
Just traveling to rest. And sometimes I'd get there and they'd say no. Sometimes they'd be like, yeah, you can have one. And obviously I wasn't getting paid a nickel for it. And that's fine. That's part of the my story, I guess, that some people, you know, have it just as rough. But I had a drive to get better. So I couldn't sit back and wait in Utah or any state and get one fight every 3 months because I'm not going to learn and I'm not going to progress. In this sport, the way you learn is getting in there and having bad things happen that you're not prepared for, and you got a split
right.
second to make the decision, and you learn from it. And there's things that happen in the cage, and as soon as I get out, you know, I call Big John or Kevin McDonald or Herb and say, hey, this just happened. This is how I handled it. Go. And I'm like, yeah, you messed that up, or no, that's how you should have handled it, or whatever it was. It's a learning experience. And, you know, because if you get an opportunity to do a Bellator or a UFC, you got to be prepared for anything. And, you know, if you get in there and something happens and you haven't run across it or seen it or know what to do, you know, you could essentially ruin your career. People aren't going to want to use you because you're the guy who, you know, really messed up a fight. And I mean, the reputation kind of follows you. And so for me, I traveled around and I got my cage time and my experience, and people called me crazy and people called me, you know, out of my mind because I would go these places and they didn't pay me a nickel. And, You know, that's just the way I got my experience. Whereas in California, you know, you can come up as a referee, you can go into the amateur ranks of reffing, and you can have all of your amateur fights done in a year or so and move on to professional fights because there are so many events. You know, and I didn't have that luxury. So, I put a lot of miles and I was gone, you know, almost, I think it was 42 or 43 weekends that year. And it certainly put a strain on things. And, you know, things happen for a reason.
Well, that's certainly admirable. I mean, and that's certainly a heavy price to pay for doing something that you love. On some level, you must have felt compelled to become the best referee that you could, almost like, you know, a personal quest, you know. What kind of a emotional fallout with your family was there from the amount of work you were doing? I mean, did you learn that there was a point that you had to say no to things? I mean, how did you determine how much to try and do?
Then I was like a bull in a china cabinet. You know, I was all go, and there was no stopping. And now it's been 7.5 years, and I've got over 5,000 fights. It's a crazy amount of fights I've got that I've done. But now I'm at the point where if it doesn't make sense, I say no. I don't need to chase as much as I did then. I still like to get in the cage, but I'm not going to drive. I lived in New York, and I would drive from New York 40 hours one way, get in the cage. When the fights were over, I would get back in my vehicle and drive back home. And I wouldn't do that today.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I know what it's like. I've driven across country, too. I mean, you know, but... That's admirable. I find it highly admirable, you know. Are you usually driving to different events, or do you fly to some of them?
I do fly to some. For me, in the beginning, obviously, when you're not getting paid anything, you take the path of the least travel, cost-wise. You know, and if I drove my truck, I could sleep in it, so I didn't have a hotel room. I didn't have the airfare. I just had gas and then the maintenance on my vehicle. So, you know, for me, that's the only way I could do it. And, you know, like I said, almost every single time I would get to an event, do it, and turn around that night and start driving home and be home on Sunday. And, you know, that's just the way I had to do it.
You must have some stories about, you know, seeing the best and worst of America in your travels, you know. I mean, do you have anything that sticks out in your mind as far as the good, bad that, you know, that you could think of?
I firmly believe from my time reffing in Alabama and Louisiana, I firmly believe the South have the nicest people, because I would go into places lost out of my mind, and every single time people went out of the way to make sure that I had the right direction. They offered me food. They offered me, you know, to lodging and stuff, especially when they found out where I was going and stuff like that. Never had a bad experience down south. Never. And, you know, that's something I say today, that I, you know, when it comes time for me to retire, I would like to live down south, because, you know, the hospitality was just unmatched. And I have reffed in 23 different states to date, so I've seen most of the country. And that's something that really sticks with me. Kind of the bad and the ugly is, you know, I've been caught in a tornado, two of them. One going from New York to Nebraska, and then one going from Minnesota to Utah. And so that wasn't real fun. And I got to tell you, I'm from the Midwest, but driving across the Midwest is boring. There's nothing there.
Yeah, I know what that's like. I can identify with that. I've driven across country like 4 or 5 times. I've never been caught in a tornado, but I've been pretty close, and that's got to be horrifying if you're caught in your car, because, you know, especially if you're like in the Midwest and like there's nowhere to go, it's like, oh my God, like what the hell are you gonna do? You know, like I couldn't imagine. I've been caught in some inclement weather, but nothing like approaching a tornado. I'm like, but if I was, I'm like, I don't know what I would do, you know.
And the crazy thing is being from the Midwest, you know, I'm used to the sirens and all that stuff. But these were both times we were in the dark, and so that made it worse. And, you know, we just got under an underpass and until it blew over and all that stuff. But you get out and there's trees all over the road, and you really are grateful that you know, it could have been a lot worse. But I've run into snowstorms that are crazy. The weather has just been crazy throughout the years.
And you must have seen the best and the worst of America in your travels. I mean, at some of these smaller MMA shows, I'm guessing. How crazy do audiences get in your experience? I mean, do you get people firing guns in the air? I mean, what about people walking around fully naked in the crowd? I mean, anything crazy like that?
I've never had any of those, and I hope I don't. But I've had corners storm the cage or the ring and actually collapse it, mm-hmm. and like have an all-out melee in there. That was bananas. Most of the time, though, the smaller shows that I go to and do, there aren't any issues. You know, the fans are respectful. You know, I talk to them whenever I get an opportunity, and you know, they're super respectful. So I haven't had really any big issues other than the ring issue.
Yeah, that's good, because we've seen some absolute bizarre moments, you know, around the cage, around the MMA world. I mean, we've seen referees choking out fighters, events canceled due to lightning striking the cage, riots with stabbings, and not just in Brazil. I mean, you know, I mean, just crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, and I'm glad that nothing has happened to you, you know, anything like that. But I believe you were also, you were the referee, if I'm not mistaken, for the fight where Courtney Casey fired a snot rocket across the cage at Felice Herrig and actually hit her, or at least partially. Am I right? Is that correct?
That is correct.
I mean, that's not too bad. I mean, that's not like, you know, anything really, really crazy. But what was going through your mind when that happened?
Well, first off, it took me a second to realize, you know, what they were doing. I mean, typically, and not all the time, but typically, when you get into a situation where the fighters really dislike one another or have a moment where they truly dislike one another, you know that ahead of time, because before the fight, obviously I go back and I talk to the fighters and you know, just kind of go through things again one-on-one, kind of make sure everything we're on the same page, things like that. And you can gauge, and they'll make comments that let you know that there's true beef. And sometimes the promoter will say, hey, you need to watch out for this fight a little closer because they truly, you know, dislike one another at the weigh-ins, this happened or whatever. So I had no indication that there was any issues. And I had ref Courtney Casey before and in the UFC. So when that happened, I was like, okay, let's slow it down. And so I just warned them. And you can see me warning them because it was in the third round and it was late in the third round when it happened. But what went through my mind is like, you know, why and, you know, what did that? And I understand it was frustration going back and looking at it. And I talked to them both in the back afterwards. But, you know, you get in there and you have adrenaline and all that going. Frustrations happen. Wasn't the biggest thing in the world to go wrong, I guess.
Yeah, that was right. You know, it's it happens. We've seen worse. I mean, MMA is sometimes a weird sport. It's the funniest sport, and also one you know, what could be one of the trashiest sport, you know, sometimes, you know. So I don't know, you know, it's pretty ironic sometimes, you know. So there's really, really nothing you can do about situations like that. You can just try to keep it under control. But fortunately, you're a high-level referee and can keep stuff like that under control. And being a good referee can win you the respect of your peers and you know, a worldwide audience. However, making a mistake can see a torrent of seemingly never-ending criticism unleashed sometimes for years and whatnot. It seems like a bit of a gamble to become involved in something which has such high stakes, even life or death ones, plus a huge amount of money with no guarantee of a real reward. Was that something you had any sense of when you started refereeing, Bobby? I mean, every time you referee, you're risking not only your own personal reputation, but also the safety of both participants who implicitly trust you to keep them safe and whatnot.
I don't think that necessarily is a big thing on my mind when I got into it. But that's the reason why a lot of people don't make it, because they don't understand the responsibilities that are on your shoulders. And you said it at the very beginning, it's very thankless. When things go right, you're not mentioned.
Yep.
Like, there's no, hey, so-and-so did a great job on this or that. But when something goes wrong, you're highlighted in every column and every interview. I mean, everything possible, you're highlighted in. And, you know,
yep.
I go back and I tell people all the time. People say, oh, you know, Herb Dean or Kevin McDonald or Rob Hines or Big John, you know, they messed up this fight. And, you know, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. You know, unless I've talked to them, I don't know what they've seen and why they did what they did. However, what people don't realize is that's one fight that maybe they messed up. What about the 1,000,
yeah.
2,000 that they haven't seen because they were on regional circuits and things like that, that they did absolutely perfect? And, you know, in baseball, you can get out 7 out of 10 times and make the Hall of Fame. In MMA, you mess up once out of 100, and you're the worst ref, and you don't deserve to be in the cage. And, you know, that's just the reality. And if you don't have thick skin and can't take the criticism, you're going to sink really fast. And, you know, ultimately, my job is, you know, it doesn't matter to me what people say about me, whether they like me or they hate me. You know, that doesn't matter. What matters is, like you said earlier, do the fighters respect me? And do they know that I'm going to command in the cage, and I'm going to be in control of that? And their safety is the only thing that matters to me. If I go in there and due to my decision making, or, you know, not being quick enough or something of that nature, and someone suffers an injury based on those facts, that may be the time when I need to quit. Because that's the only reason why I'm in there is for their safety.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, every time you referee, you're not only risking your own personal reputation, but and more importantly, the safety of both participants who, you know, implicitly trust you to keep them safe. And that has to play on your mind, you know, and it sounds like in your case that plays the most heavily on your mind. How nervous are you before an event?
The first time I ref and got the opportunity, I threw up probably 10 minutes before the show started. It's one of those things where you think you're ready until you get the call, and then, I mean, you may be ready, but you're nervous as heck. Now, I don't know that I get as nervous. I think if a referee, even if Herb or John or somebody would say, you know, I don't get nervous when I get in there, I think they may be not telling the whole truth, because I think that the nerves is something that keeps us alert and aware and very non-complacent. You know, and I'm assuming if you ask those guys, they would agree. I mean, it's the nerves and the energy that keeps you laser focused and brings you back to the reason why you're in there. And you know, so there's always the nerves, but it's not the same where, you know, I get ill or anything like that in the beginning as new refs would experience.
Yeah, very, very good point. You know, Are there any times where you're struck by the magnitude of what you do and the fact that the decision you make could potentially have life and death consequences?
It especially happens as I reflect back on an event, whether it's big or small. When I'm done with it, and just like Valor tomorrow, I mean, this is something special, and you can feel it. And, you know, I believe that from what I see and what I hear, that Valor is going to be around for a while, and it's going to be something special for the fans and for the fighters. So tomorrow night after I'm done, I will take a few minutes, and I reflect back, and I think about things that happened and maybe things I could have done differently and things like that. But it's only when the fights are over that I reflect back, because, you know,
yeah.
If you're doing it beforehand, then your mind's not going to be in the right spot. And, you know, you'll hear that, you know, one of the other things is I'm a huge fan of the sport. Like, I love the sport. And whenever I'm not in the cage, I'll watch the fights wherever they're at if I can. However, in my entire career, I've met some of the biggest names. I've never asked for a picture. I've never went up and, you know, tried to introduce myself any other way than just as the referee that'll be doing that fight type of thing. And I think that level of respect from the fighters is there as well, because they know what you're there for.
Very good point. Yeah, absolutely. It's often said that the less aware the audience is of referee, that the better job they're actually doing. Is there a sweet spot in terms of your overall recognition as a skilled referee, but without becoming a distraction or the focus of the fight that someone in your position has to strive for?
Well, and I don't think that statement is one that a lot of people say, the best referee is the one that's not seen or heard. And that's not accurate, because when I'm seen and I'm heard, that's because the fighters have forced my hand and gotten me involved in the fight because of a foul or something like that. It's not because I'm just interjecting to interject. So I don't think that the best referee is the one that isn't seen or heard, because, you know, if somebody creates a foul or something happens and you've got to make a decision, when I got in the cage, I didn't say, hey, I'm going to make this decision tonight. No, the fighters put me in that position, and I had to make that decision to, you know, keep the fight fair, safe, and, you know, take care of both parties, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You're definitely someone that fans are aware of, but you're not I wouldn't categorize you as a celebrity figure in the MMA world in the sense like someone like Big John McCarthy might be considered. Am I underselling your notoriety there, in your opinion, Bobby?
I think everybody I think everybody has a certain level and a certain fan base that follows them. But I don't think any of us are celebrities. I think all the referees would tell you that. You know, our job isn't to be known or be the celebrity. It's to, you know, take care of the fighter and make sure they come back to fight another day. So whether people, like I said, whether people follow me or they don't, you know, I've got a job to do, and that doesn't deter or impede that.
Although I should point out, though, there is a Bobby Wambacher parody, a Twitter account. So I don't know if you're aware of that. So that there is, you know, somebody out there, you know, at least impersonating you on Twitter. So go figure.
Yeah, I was made aware of it. I don't use Twitter, so. I have an account on there, but I haven't been on there in a long time. And I was made aware of it. And for me, I'm just flattered that someone takes their time to do that. So more power to them.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, there's obviously a certain level of recognition there and whatnot. And, you know, that there's a sweet spot in terms of your overall recognition as a skilled referee. But you know that there's it comes without becoming a distraction or you know taking away the focus of the fight, which is I think very very important. When not I should note that I mean some of the humor of that account appears to be playing on the phrase let's get after it, which I believe you say at the start of the fights, if I'm not mistaken, because
right.
Big John says let's get it on. You know, it seems many referees have tried to adopt something unique or original to start matches, as we see. And I understand, even though not everyone chooses a good phrase, Cecil Peoples has that karate or kung fu pose that he does, you know, in the beginning and whatnot. Have you ever crossed paths with Grandmaster Cecil Peoples on your travels?
I have at a King of the Cage, but I don't remember. It's been a while ago. It's been many, many years ago. He's done a lot for the sport, and he's one of the originals.
I like to get him on the program maybe at some point and whatnot. You know, he seems like a really, really interesting guy, you know. But anyway, what was the? I have to ask you about kind of wrapping up here. I know that you probably have a long day tomorrow. You got a lot of stuff going on there in North Dakota. But I wanted to talk, a little bit about Steve Mazzagatti. And get maybe some of your opinions about him. I don't want you to criticize, a fellow colleague, whatnot. But there seems to be some moments where you could see, or maybe some of the referees' calls and, could be construed as being incorrect. Are there any moments that you'd like to care to share with the folks at home where you thought maybe someone or a referee did something, worthy of criticism? I mean, one referee I think who takes a lot of criticism is Steve Mazzagatti, who Dana White seems to intentionally try to blackball out of the sport. I mean, even Herb Dean, recently has been criticized a lot. I've criticized Herb on Twitter, but as you said earlier, it's a thankless job. It's a very, very difficult job. I understand that and whatnot. But going back to Mazzagatti, he's clearly, I think, made some mistakes and whatnot. In some of the fights that he's reffed and whatnot. And Dean does a great job a lot of the time. But he may have been just up against a rough spot and whatnot. And every referee makes mistakes. It's impossible not to, and that goes with every sport. But what's your take on the way people seem to punish referees for making errors, Bobby? And do you think Mazzagatti gets a fair shake?
The first thing I would say is if you disagree with a referee's decision or whatever, I would reach out to them or something and get a what they had seen. Because sometimes things happen and the cameras catch certain things, and like sometimes a fighter will go out and they'll get knocked out, and as a referee we are generally inches to a foot away from the action. And one of the things that I look at is are their eyes, and if their eyes roll back in the back of their head, they're out and they hit the fighting surface or whatever, and they come back to immediately. Obviously the fans think they can still continue, and that's not a fact. They were out. Because they got woken up doesn't mean, in our sport they don't get a 10 count. If they're out, they're out.
Right.
And so to see what the referee sees in whatever situation, I think that's more important to figure out. However, like you said, we all make mistakes. And everybody that you listed there would be the first to tell you that we all make mistakes. I think Steve Mazzagatti is a good referee. I think one of the things he's underrated on is he's phenomenal at Muay Thai and kickboxing and things like that. And I think that he's a good referee, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think the problem is that people are so emotionally invested in sports, which is why so much money gets pumped into them that things go wrong. They feel a sense of injustice and kinds of a righteous anger. You know, do you think that maybe plays into it, that it's just, you know, personal bias that gets pumped into this?
I absolutely do. I think people get invested for different reasons. You know, their favorite fighter, whatever it is. And if you make a call that goes against their fighter, whether it's right or wrong, obviously you don't know what you're doing. And so I think people do get extremely emotionally invested. And I guess the one way to prove that is, you know, when I go to watch a fight, say a Buffalo Wild Wings or whatever, you'll hear people saying stuff like it's crazy the things that people say and their rationale behind what they're saying. And, you know, you just sit there and you're processing it like, okay, that isn't even anything that goes into that decision, or that doesn't even make sense. But that's what they believe, so that's what it is. And people get on, they write on Twitter and all that other stuff. So then it becomes, fact, and it's not. So,
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And you're someone I don't associate with any high-profile errors, at least, you know, without doing a lot of research. Have there been moments in your career where you felt you made the wrong call, at least in the heat of the moment? Do any stand out in particular?
There's only one time where, in my personal opinion, that I had messed up. And it was an amateur fight, and I went back immediately to the locker room, and I told the person who lost, I explained what I seen, why I did what I did, and I informed them that I made a mistake, and I told them to appeal it to the board, the commission, and I showed up at the hearing, and I told them there that, you know, I had made a mistake. This is what I had seen. This is why I had made that decision. However, in retrospect, it was the incorrect decision, and this is why. And and I think that's very important to face any mistake that you make. I've literally got a split second to make a decision, and
sure.
You know, if I make a mistake, I need to own up to it and do right by the fighter, because that's what I'm there for.
Well, that's good. That's kind of big on you. I don't know if most referees would do that. You know, go so far as to show up at a hearing and admit that's actually pretty big. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's the right thing to do, and if it happens again, I would do the exact same thing.
All right, real quickly before I go, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know it's late there and it's late here. I'm actually headed to my second job pretty soon. But I wanted to talk to you about your charity, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is called Fighting for Autism. Am I right about that?
There are a few that I'm associated with. That is one of them. Another one is the Lane Logan Memorial. Both of those I'm pretty passionate about.
I know a lot of people get involved in autism awareness and advocacy because they have a personal connection to it, often through family members. And like, was that the case for you, Bobby? I mean, how did you get involved with this worthy cause?
At the time, my stepson at the time, he has autism, and that's what got me involved as far as being aware of what was going on and things like that. And I just wanted to help and do more. And do anything I could. So that's how I got involved. And then over the years, I have been able to, go meet people, fans of the sports that had autism. I brought some young kids and their families to fight, and put them cage side and let them listen to the rules meeting.
Oh wow!
And, just try to make it an experience for them. And then I stay in touch with them and make sure they're doing well and things like that, and that the families are doing well.
tell me about the organization you've started and the sort of function that it performs.
What's that?
Tell me about the organization you've started and the sort of function it performs.
The Fighting for Autism?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't start that. I'm just a part of it. It was actually started in England. But what we do is we try to give people, whether they're adults or children that have autism, an opportunity. And, you know, we give them opportunities to train. We give them opportunities to fight. In Missouri, they actually, in several states, they have a category for that, and they can actually fight as well. So it's giving them the same opportunities that everybody else has, and, you know, just showing that they're no different.
Is that something that people listening to can support in different ways?
Absolutely. Like I said, Fighting for Autism was started in England. We have a chapter here in the U.S., but they could go on to Fighting for Autism, and they can donate to the foundation, and, you know, that money obviously goes to autistic families and, you know, their training expenses, their medical expenses and things like that. So that's what I would recommend, is just to go there, and if they wanted to donate money, do it there, and, you know, allow the corporate people to decide what best use for it is.
Yeah, that's amazing. And we as a society need to do more for autistic people, to help them with any challenges they may experience, to understand it, and you know, to help out and whatnot, because we're probably going to need to help individuals with autism to organize the plan if we keep on filling it up, you know, with stuff. You know, I mean, that's a joke for my autistic friends and whatnot, but I definitely commend the MMA community for its support of autism related charities, though. That feels like one of the things we can actually be proud of, and hopefully it balances out some of the abusers and crazy people to pay to watch the fight. Is there anything that else we should let people know about before we go?
Yeah, well, I had mentioned the Lane Logan Memorial, and I highly suggest people to get on and check them out as well. What they do is they provide service dogs for soldiers that come back with PTSD, and that's very, very expensive. If you look into it, you know, to get a dog, to get them trained, to get them with the soldier with PTSD, and do the training, it's very, very expensive, very costly. Most places charge for that. The Lane Logan Memorial does not. They select the recipients and make sure it's a match and go from there, and that the recipient doesn't come out of their pocket with anything. And for me, you know, we ask our soldiers to do a lot, and I'm very passionate about helping them out. If they come back with PTSD or whatever, for giving me the opportunity to live my dreams and my freedoms that everybody has, you know, we should take care of them and you know, make sure they have what they need for their sacrifices.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I have a lot of respect now, but a lot more respect that I've talked to you, and it's been great, you know, listening to you and having this conversation. I hope that you can come back and talk to us about some of the more issues that maybe we couldn't explore today, and some other stuff you've got going on and whatnot. I wish you the best of luck tomorrow. It should be a very, very fun and historic event there. Please, if you see Ken, please say hello to Ken for me. Ken has been doing a great job promoting this and making the rounds, and I hope this is a very, very successful event, and one for the ages, and one of many. And Bobby, I applaud you, man. You're definitely a pillar of the sport, a class act, and thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, and I'd love to come back anytime.
Thank you, Bobby. I appreciate it. Good luck with everything, and we'll see you sometime down the road.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right. Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Bobby Wambacher. Yeah, awesome. You know, awesome. Seems like a really, really good guy. Very, very good referee, and somebody we want to have on in the program. And it's good work what he's doing with autistic charities and you know, personal connection to autism. And just seems like a really, really all around good guy. Good guy that we want to have in the MMA community. And you know, and we'll see him tomorrow night. See him tomorrow night at the Valor Bare Knuckle event in North Dakota there. Okay. All right, that's it. That's it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. My name is Robert Carlson, Bob Carson. Okay. I got to go to my 15th job. I got to go to my second job now. I'm going to quit this job very, very soon. I got a lot of things going on, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of things going on, training in a bunch of different places. So keep it locked in to Carson's Corner. You can follow me on Instagram, instagram.com/BobCarsonMMA. Follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. BlogTalkRadio.com/Carson's Corner. That's it. Keep in contact. Let me know what's going on. We'll be back next week with another show. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.